This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean and surrounding counties. And we're going to have a great show for you today. If you would like to call into our station, of course, our number is 807-2427. And you can go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com, and get a lot of information about our station. I do want to mention that we are sponsoring a trip that is coming up here in September. It's September 21st. I believe that's on a Saturday. And we will be taking a trip up to Indiana, and there will be visiting a shrine there. Maybe Lynn can mention a little bit more about it if you'd like to, Lynn. If not, you know, I just wanted to make sure people remember that that trip will be coming up, and you need to call and get signed up for that.
Yes. When you call, well, not before you call, we're going to St. John's, Indiana, which is just over the border, up near Gary, up in that area. There's a shrine there of the Passion of Christ. They're lifelike figures that are put throughout. It would be like the Stations of the Cross, but a few were added to that. Christ's resurrection's added to it. Jesus meeting with Mary Magdalene after he arose from the dead. There is a replica of the tomb where he was buried. All these life-size figures are cast in, I don't know if it's brass or whatever it is, but it's beautiful. They're very realistic, down to what the Roman soldiers wore at, you know, their buttons and everything. Very realistic. There's much to see up there. And then they're going to one of the churches that you can see from there that was fairly newly built. Very interesting to see that. And then the statue of Our Lady, which toured the country for the millennium. And she was taken, the statue was taken all over the country. She is, I forget how tall, but she's huge. Her May crown was there at the time I was there. They just had it sitting on this table. Well, the crown was a round table. The crown was just, I thought, I can't believe how big it was just to fit on the head of this statue of Mary.
It should be a really interesting trip, and for people who, it's about a mile walk, they say, around through all the various, the Stations of the Cross?
Like I say, and a little more added to it.
And a little bit more added to it, and it's a nice, smooth, walkway, I should say.
It's all paved.
And paved, and there are benches all along the way for people to stop and rest. But if people don't feel up to walking that far, then there is also transportation available that will take you to place to place for an extra $5. The whole trip is $75. You can get more information on it on our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. You can call the station, 807-2427, but that's September 21st, and make sure you mark that on your calendar.
Yes, you'll have to make reservations ahead of time. And when you make those reservations, be sure to tell them if you do want to go on the tram or not. That's when they book all that stuff, is at that time. And the gift shop, for the ladies especially, and men that are interested in looking and seeing all these religious articles. It's the biggest religious book shop that I've ever seen in my life. You'll love it.
It's a great trip, and it's just a day trip. It's not too far to go. There will be food provided and stops along the way, so make sure you get signed up for that. At any rate, it will help support Catholic Spirit Radio, and if you listen to our station, and you should encourage other people to listen to it, it will give you a wonderful trip and at the same time help you support Catholic Spirit Radio. And remember, Catholic Spirit Radio is brought to you by you. We're a listener-supported station, and we need your help. And you might ask the question, who needs Catholic Spirit Radio? And you do. And in addition to that, we're going to have a great show. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, as you just heard. And speaking of who needs Catholic Spirit Radio, we can also ask about our own religious tradition. Who needs Catholic religious tradition and subsidiarity? And our nation needs it. You need it. And Catholicism has it. And that brings me to the topic that I want to talk about for the first part of our show. It's a very interesting topic. I was reading in the Weekly Standard an article. It's called A Modest Proposal, and it's three lessons from Hayek, and they're talking about the Austrian economist, F.A. Hayek, and he published an article in 1945 concerning information, the use of knowledge in society was the title of the article. In that article, in 1945, he explained why so many of the socialist and communist nations get into so much trouble, because it's when you centralize things and move them too far away from the localities of the people themselves in any given country, you are unable to gather enough information, that is, useful information, that is actually located out at the more local areas throughout a country. And that is the whole idea of Catholic tradition and Catholic subsidiarity, is the idea of keeping everything at the parish level that can be done at the parish level. And then if it can't be done at the parish level, moving it up only to the diocesan level. And then if it can't be done at the diocesan level, up to the archdiocesan level. And only through those, before you go up further, you know, to the centrality of the Vatican or the Magisterium and the Pope. So by keeping things local, we keep the information local. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. And that's what I wanted to talk about, this article by F.A. Hayek. It was written, of course, 73 years ago, 1945. But it's still very, very pertinent today. And it applies today. And we have seen that. And we'll talk a little bit about what's happened in Venezuela. And, of course, we saw what happened with the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Soviet Union. We really didn't bring it down exactly. Ronald Reagan, I always give credit to him, Margaret Thatcher, and our Pope for helping to change the Soviet Union, to bring it, to dissolve it. But nevertheless, most of that was done by the Soviet Union itself, simply by trying to base itself on the structure of total centralization, and it just doesn't work. Acquiring more and more territory and more power, and then gravitating that power to a central authority doesn't really work. It seems that we're on that track again, and that's why I think it's important to talk about this article from 1945 by F.A. Hayek, the Austrian economist. Probably people have heard of him. I don't think that he's still alive now, but he hasn't. It hasn't been that long ago that he was still around. So we'll talk about that. And I think in doing that, we'll talk about some local things, how it applies locally, a local example as well. But anyway, he was giving that response in 1945 after World War II, because there was a big movement then, and for the idea of planned economies, the idea of the Soviet Union, of communist China, and those kinds of things. And its lessons can be generalized to us. He was making an argument, a very profound argument. He said, we must appreciate the limited ability of central authorities to collect and use information. Even if we could make a government agency that was lean, efficient, and staffed only with able and selfless professionals, you know, and that's not an easy thing to do, as everyone well knows. But he pointed out, even if we could do it, it would still struggle to achieve its ambitions. And why would it do that? Because of the problem of information. Information is always local, and it's not easy to gather at a centralized point. The roadblock, he says, isn't intentions. I mean, you know, people always have good intentions, of course. The road to perdition is paved with good intentions. But it's information that is the problem. It's a problem of the utilization of knowledge, Hayek wrote, which is not given to anyone in its totality. No one can ever have all the information necessary, much less all of it smartly combined and analyzed to make the right decisions. And we see that every day. I mean, if people get out and knock on doors, I was in sales and, you know, got out a lot when I was younger, knocking on doors and seeing different things. Just go around your community sometime and take a look at all of the little tiny businesses and so forth that you see all over, all doing different things. It's incredible if you really go out and start really looking. And then knock on doors and talk to people, and you'll find out that they're dealing with, you know, myriads of problems, family problems, sometimes personal problems, problems of, you know, practicality in town and so forth that they know about and so forth. There's just a tremendous amount of diversity and information out there, the real diversity that is out there that doesn't call attention to itself. And to try and regulate and run all of that and from a centralized location is to destroy much of the glue that holds a society and a culture together. So he says, in his words, the knowledge of the circumstances of which we must make use never exists in concentrated or integrated form, but solely as the dispersed bits of incomplete and frequently contradictory knowledge which all the separate individuals possess. In other words, the countless minds thinking about, engaged in, and influenced by a policy matter will always know more in combination than any single body or any single particular group. And then the author, Andy Smarek, that is writing this article about Hayek, goes on to say, what I glean from Hayek's article is a five-part test that should be used by government officials prior to acting. And that test consists of five questions he asks. And any group that actually thinks that it can act on behalf of a huge amount of people should ask itself, are you certain you have the information necessary to act wisely? It's very difficult to acquire it. Who are the experts who could acquire all the relevant information and translate it into a smart policy? And then, assuming such experts exist, how would you find them? It's not so easy to do. And can all the relevant information spread across countless interested parties be translated into a form that can be used by a single authority? Even if you had access to it all, how do you translate it into some kind of a form? And then finally, since the conditions on the ground change constantly, can the necessary information be rapidly and continuously sent by the field to the governing body? And can we get the information from the locality to the field? None of these things are easy. And it's so easy to think in terms of one big grandiose plan and how it will accomplish things and what it will do and won't it be wonderful. But the devil is always in the details. And we're gonna talk about it here, a local example my wife and I will talk about that gives the example of the devil in those details. And Smart goes on to say, in my experience, government bodies often decide to act and then use whatever information is available to decide how to act. And I think we see that in this big movement toward we're going to have free college education, we're going to have all of these other programs that, you know, the government is going to do now that they propose that we're going to have a guaranteed income for people, a guaranteed minimum income for people. It all sounds good, and it's all being proposed. But let's take a look at what really happened with communist China, what happened with the Soviet Union, and what happened in Venezuela. And you can even say that, you know, in Venezuela, we don't even have to count this as necessarily communism in the sense that we always used to understand communism, but just too much government. Let's an example that Mr. Smarek gives is the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. Government decided they wanted to hold schools accountable for results. Sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, we do have, you know, public schools, and we do have a National Education Association at the national level, of course. So wouldn't this be a good idea? They used reading and math test scores largely because that was the information that was available. But it was a failure. In the case of education accountability, the federal government might have first asked, what are all the things that we care about when it comes to school performance? And they didn't ask them. I mean, math scores and reading scores, is that it? I mean, take a look at a local school level. Say we went back to our little tiny schools and suppose we had a so-called inefficient school, but suppose that school was doing a great job of moral teaching. What's more important? Knowing how to read as well as you could, and you know, it would be good, of course, and knowing math as well as you could, or if you had kids that were going out and they had a solid moral foundation and they thought in terms of marriage lasting forever. They thought in terms of keeping their family together. They thought in terms of, you know, having children that would contribute to the good of the community and taking care of those children. They took whatever job that they could find at the level they were able to work, and they stuck to it, worked hard, saved their money, were frugal. Can you imagine some of the businesses and so forth that would be started with sheer, you know, persistency because these people had a good, solid moral foundation? Good, solid families, and so forth. I mean, we can't measure in how many things, how much good that they could do for a community and how that could translate into businesses and growth, because these people would be humble enough and persistent enough to ask others who knew more than they did for the information and things that they needed. Wouldn't this be a far more important thing to learn than just to be glib? I'm glib in reading and writing, but is that, you know, the only thing? Or to be good at math scores? We have to look at, we could let local people look at their local schools from a local point of view and ask themselves what kind of thing it is doing. And do some of the regulations that we have in our society concerning our Constitution itself stifle a lot of the kind of learning I was talking about? The idea that religious convictions and religious virtues have to be somehow kept apart or ignored because they're somehow or another imposing something on somebody else? Is it wrong to coach and encourage people in terms of good moral behavior? Or is it something that we should ignore? I mean, you know, you cannot take something from the local level and condense it into something at the top and have the same thing. And, I guess we're coming up here. I'm taking up more time than I thought. We'll talk about this a little bit more, and then we'll come back to some other things. But these are some of the things that Hayek addressed and said that a government at the top level that is, in effect, the controlling factor of all the institutions of society simply doesn't have the information, no matter how good its intentions and how wonderful it would like things to be. It simply doesn't have the information to do it. And if its intentions are not good, then that's even worse. But at any rate, we're going to take a break here. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Are you aware that Catholic Spirit Radio produces a liturgical commentary for your reflection? This commentary is based on each day's gospel reading and provides enlightening ideas and explanations. Written by an award-winning catechist from the Diocese of Peoria, commentaries are released at 9 a.m. daily through the station's Facebook page. Be sure to check us out, like us, and share. More information is available at CatholicSpiritRadio.com.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic. We're back from our break, and we were talking about the information problem that a centralized society faces and how it can be very devastating to a society, and how one of the Austrian economists, F.A. Hayek, laid out this problem in 1945, talked about no matter how well-intentioned a government may be that centralizes things, that those central policies eventually crowd out all the information at the local level. And that's where information actually is spread out, and a centralized level far away from that can never gain the information necessary to really run the society and the culture in a proper way that it can be run by all those individuals that carry all that information spread out, very difficult to gather together in one spot, spread out at a local level. So we've been talking about that. And as a local example, I just want to give, and this might be a little bit humorous, my wife and I have been sort of contending with this problem. I want to talk about right here in our own community, Bloomington Normal. You can imagine what this would be like if it were, you know, something that had to be settled from the top. But at any rate, not too long ago, and I'm sure most people here in town noticed that there are those stop for pedestrian signs in the crosswalks where the Constitution Trail crosses the roads in Normal. We have one at the Rab Road. I think there's one also down on Lincoln. I think
Shelbourne.
Down on Shelbourne. And then also on Willow, I think one. And is there one on College? I'm not sure about College.
But I don't know. There's a stoplight down there.
Yeah. But at any rate, there's these little stop signs that are right in the middle of the road. It's got a little sign, a little yellow pole that holds up a little sign. It's got a picture of a stop sign on it. It's small, but it is a picture of a stop sign. And then, of course, below that, it says, cars are must stop for pedestrians and crosswalks. Well, of course, there's nothing new about the fact that automobiles have to stop for pedestrians and crosswalks. Nothing new about that at all. That's always been the law. In fact, you have to stop for pedestrians that are in the road anywhere, whether they're in the middle of the road, a crosswalk, or anywhere else. But, of course, we are especially careful at crosswalks because that's where most people, cross. But the whole idea is, of course, that pedestrians need to stop, look, and listen and wait before they cross the street. Because regardless of what the law is, regardless that traffic is mandatory to stop, cars can't always stop, or sometimes maybe people aren't looking and they just don't stop. And if there's a collision between a pedestrian and an automobile, of course, the pedestrian is going to lose regardless of whether he's right or wrong. So, that's how it's been. And on the Constitution Trail, there have always been signs for pedestrians to stop. There's been little stop signs actually posted on posts at the street crossings. So pedestrians are supposed to stop. But Lynn and I have noticed, and I think you have noticed, you might chime in on this, it seems that with these little signs, with the stop sign on it, put in the middle of the street, that it's getting confusing, and there are more pedestrians and bikers who think that somehow they have the right-of-way out there, in the sense that they can just simply go out into the street and cars will be stopping.
And I think that's they're becoming... They're relying on that anymore. Many of them are. I've seen many. They'll just keep on going. They don't even look. They don't even hesitate. The people that on their bikes and walking their dogs, it's just as if there was no sign there at all about anything. And I think, too, a driver in a car doesn't know. I've seen the hesitation. They don't know whether there's nobody there, whether they're supposed to stop or not. And some of them do. They just don't know when to stop. And I'm very concerned that somebody's really going to get hurt one of these days, because it's either a stop sign and you stop or it's not. This leaves, it's not the size of a regular stop sign. And it's set in this oblong-like sign posted there. And then it tells you, if pedestrians are in the walkway. Well, you can stop and read the sign.
The point is, I guess, is that, it is confusing. And it could be dangerous also, not just for pedestrians, but for people driving their cars, too. I mean, if somebody goes up there, if most people pull up and slow down, and that's a good thing, of course, that they slow down, and watch for people in the crosswalk, and that's a good thing, too. But some people actually stop, even if there's nobody out in the street. This can cause, of course, a rear-end collision from people behind that don't think that that little stop sign means stop. So the point is confusing, and the point we're trying to make here is that somehow I don't think that the city managers, the engineers, the architects, and so forth of our streets came up with this idea. I think it was input from somewhere else, probably from some people who are concerned about the trail, or maybe from walkers or bikers, or maybe there's some group, speaks for bikers or pedestrians. I'm not sure that's concerned, about recreational areas and so forth. And they're probably trying to do a good thing. and they gave input to the city somehow, wanted some kind of a more of a control there, and you get cars to slow down. And so the intentions, of course, are good, and you know, again, with the good intentions. But there are some problems here. Now, I don't know exactly what the solution should be, and if you talk to people, we did in church, didn't we, Lynn, with some of our groups, and you get what was the result of that?
It's kind of split. Everybody says you're supposed to stop for people crossing the street.
Well, you are, but does that encourage people to go out into the street, you know, in front of a car?
Have common sense. Well, how can you have common sense when you don't, when you understand the law says one thing and what actually is happening is another? The other thing I'm concerned about, there are two other things, actually. One is the trail runs from south to north, right?
Yes.
So whenever you're crossing it going east or going west. And where does the sun rise? Out of the east. Where does the sun set? Out of the west. So the driver in a car is blinded much of the time by the sun setting or rising. You can't see as well. And people are coming out of the darkness, of, you know, like at Shelbourne especially. There are a lot of trees along the trail. And those trees, it keeps it dark and cool in there, which is great. But you can hardly see them at that time of the morning, early in the morning, and that sun's in your eyes. The other thing that kind of worries me is we teach little children, you come to a corner, you stop, you look, you listen. What of that are we losing? When they're on the trail, are they supposed to follow the example of some adults that just go right through, don't even stop, look, and listen? They just depend on this is the law.
But the point is, I guess, with all of this, is that here was a situation where input came from a group, somebody at the local level at least, into the authorities, and they are trying to act, of course, to do something about this and make things safer. But there's confusion, and things could get more dangerous. The point is that at least at the local level, if people are aware of this, probably can go to city meetings, talk to our local authorities, and see if there's a better way to solve this. You know, I have my ideas. Other people have their ideas. It's amazing when you think that you know the right answers, and then you start talking with a number of people, you get lots of different points of view that you never even expected. My point I'm making is this is one little local problem. I think it's a problem. I think that drivers, I can tell by just what they do, slowing down but not sure whether or not that stop sign really means stop. I asked, what does a stop sign mean to a number of people in our little group, and they all said it means stop. I said, is there any particular size it has to be? They said no, but I said, do you stop for that stop sign? They all said no, that they slow down instead. Of course, that's the way we've been trained, to slow down for crosswalks, not to stop exactly. And the sign itself underneath that stop sign says that, to, must stop for people in crosswalk. Well, if there's nobody in the crosswalk, do you have to stop? Well, you got a stop sign, even though it's small. I mean, so it's confusing, and I think it should be resolved. But the point is that's one little thing. Can you imagine multiplying that by hundreds and hundreds of more, even more important things than that? Although I think that's very important. It could mean lives at stake. The point is that if this had to go all the way to Washington, D.C., and people there had to try to somehow or another govern all these things, you can understand what Hayek is talking about. There's just so much diverse information out there that it's not an easy thing to do from a centralized point of view. And that's what tends to happen when we have this centralized authority under socialism, communism, or whatever you want to happen to call it. And we were seeing that, I think, with Venezuela. We can see how quickly that country deteriorated under a socialized or, you know, communized, if you want to say it, form of government. The people there are no longer concerned with getting socialism. They're concerned with getting what, Lynn?
They want something for nothing.
Well, what are the people now concerned about actually getting? What do they really need?
Toilet paper.
There you go. That was Lynn's worry about toilet paper and water. I mean, that's what these people are concerned about. This is what it has been reduced down to. I mean, they don't have food. They don't have toilet. They don't have water because government can't run things at a local level that can be run by the free market. Now, the free market, I'm not saying is everything, but nevertheless, the more decentralized we can get and defer problems down to a local level, the better. And that simply doesn't happen when you socialize everything, especially when the federal government is going to run all these programs. And so many, even, you know, the look at the trouble we're having with the Affordable Care Act. There's fighting over it. There's high costs. You can make cases on both sides. But the point is that it's very difficult from way up on high to impose some kind of a policy that will cover everybody and still at the same time work well, unless those policies sometimes are more simple. And sometimes you can do it and sometimes you can't. But it shouldn't be done unless it's not doable at the local level. And that's what the Catholic Church teaches, and I think that's what's so important about our religion, is that nothing should be done at a higher level if it can be done at the lower level. We shouldn't do things at a diocesan level that we can do at a parish level, and we shouldn't do things at a higher diocesan level, archdiocesan level, that we can do at the diocesan level. And we shouldn't do things at the Vatican level that can be done with the archdiocesan or diocesan level. And it's the same thing in society. We should devolve central authority down to the local level. The Catholic Church's tradition does that. And I want to point out that how, you know, tradition works. The church doesn't come up with some kind of an idea and then impose it before there's a problem. If you look at all of the dogmatic and doctrinal rulings in the Catholic Church of the past, it's always been after a problem has already arisen for quite some time and seems not to be resolvable at local levels. Let's just take an example, the problem of transubstantiation. Jesus Christ said, you know, this is my body, this is my blood. And the apostles and their successors took that literally and said that the bread and the wine are actually transformed into the blood and body of Christ, and that was taken literally. The people, the Jewish Pharisees and others that walked away from Christ took it literally. When he started talking that way, they walked away from him and said, "Who can listen to this? It's a hard saying. I mean, how can somebody give us his flesh to eat? How can somebody give us his blood to drink?" I mean, you know, they were stunned and disgusted and walked away. So they took it literally, and the church took it literally. And that went on okay for quite a while. People believed that this was the case, that somehow the wine and bread became the body and blood. But it wasn't until a few hundred years later that they actually began asking questions, how is this done? How does this happen? And, of course, when they tried to explain it, some people gave pretty good explanations. Other people gave pretty poor explanations, and there was a lot in between, and there were all kinds of problems, and everybody started arguing with everybody else over as to how this can happen. And this went on for quite a long time, about 250 years or so. And finally, there had to be a definition that answered that problem, and at the same time didn't contradict other doctrine that was laid down by Christ and other teachings of the church. And the explanation of transubstantiation came about that way, in response to problems at a local level, not the other way around. The church didn't come out and say, "Hey, we're going to have this new idea of transubstantiation, and here's a definition of it," and ram it down everybody's throats. It came from problems, and that's how the church has solved things mostly throughout its history. Not always perfectly. Sometimes, you know, there have been, it has been the other way around. But usually when it's the other way around, there's a problem. So usually in Catholicism, when problems crop up, the church mulls those problems and lets people try to address them for a long time before it ever comes in and acts officially. And I think that's what we need, the same thing in government. And for all of these quick solutions, such as Bernie Sanders and some of the others now that are championing all these things are very dangerous. Lynn, you want to comment some more on that?
Well, I'm still looking at the local level and how we're doing things. That's fine. You know, they do things at the local level. But sometimes when you go up in a society like we have, where not everybody believes that, you know, in doing everything at the local level, you get this interference in the next level and the next level. And pretty soon you got signs that people don't know how to obey and so on and so forth. They don't know what to do.
Well, I agree. What's your point? Sometimes there's too much, the people at the local level try to interfere too much with the...
Well, sometimes at the local level, it's a small group of people that work to get what they want.
Exactly. Can you imagine? That's what I'm saying. And it can be a problem. And at least at the local level, it's a little more solvable. I agree with you. But can you imagine how much worse it is if you had a centralized authority that was clear in Washington, D.C., and you had a group of people there who had their ear, and they got their solutions, you know, into their minds, and it was passed clear on down to us down here, far, far away, it would even be harder to get that problem solved. That's my point.
Yeah, I can see your point, because we would have a hard enough time getting the problem of these signs and doing it better. It would be a hard thing to get people together on that.
Right, and maybe
right here in this community.
And maybe Lynn and I are exaggerating the problem with the signs. I don't know if everybody else thinks of it that way or not, but if they do, then, you know.
Come down Rab Road one day at when the schools are getting out and Heartland's getting out and people are getting out from work, and somebody goes a short distance and then sees a sign and stops. And the traffic is backed up between school and Linden Street.
Anyway, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back with a different topic. I just wanted to show an example of how, you know, local information is important. So we're going to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Join Catholic Spirit Radio's pilgrimage to the Shrine of Christ Passion in St. John, Indiana on Saturday, September 22nd. Participants will feel as though they have been transported back to the time of Christ. The Shrine's Way of the Cross includes 40 life-size bronze figures placed in landscaped gardens that look and feel like the Holy Land. For more details and to register, visit CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Have questions? Call Carolyn at 309-830-4164.
Mitch McVicker is coming to Bloomington for a live concert on Sunday, July 29th.
Monday, I'll be sitting up in heaven on an easy chair, sipping lemonade. Love lives there.
Mitch is a talented musician and songwriter of 11 albums, plus a winner of a Dove Award for Song of the Year with Rich Mullins.
My deliverer is coming. My deliverer is standing by.
Since recovering from a tragic car accident, he's performed over 1,800 concerts. His family-friendly performance will entertain and inspire you.
One of these days I just might lose my mind. One of these days I might be leaving.
The free July 29th concert and reception begins at 6:30 p.m. at St. Mary's Church in Bloomington.
Let me tell you about his love is right here, his love is right now.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio, 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM. And we were talking about information, the Hayek talk, or Hayek wrote a paper, F.A. Hayek wrote a paper on use of knowledge in society. And we talked about that a little bit. Now we're going to talk about another topic, and I want to go on to that. So I'll turn this over to my wife, Lynn. And we want to talk a little bit about a book that she has read, and I'll let her introduce that.
Yes, the book is, the title of it is, The Catholic Church, Saved My Marriage by Dr. David Anders. This is a very recent book. It just came out on the shelves within the last 2 months, I believe. And his Anders' comment on it is just that he discovered hidden grace in the sacrament of marriage. Now, people that listen to EWTN during the week pretty faithfully, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, standard time, our time, Dr. David Anders has a call-in show called Call to Communion. And we have to understand that Dr. Anders has his PhD in theology. He was a Presbyterian all the way through his time in education. He was a staunch Presbyterian for a long time and grew up in that side of Protestantism that taught that God gave the special the church to the Protestants or something, and the Catholic Church was a no-no. You know, we avoid those people. Don't get involved with them. They're a cult. So he came a long way in his studies when he began to study his graduate studies, and a little before that, it was through the reading of the doctors of the church and the early disciples and so forth, all the things he could get his hands on to understand the Catholic Church, so that when he got up and gave an argument against it, he would have all the fact. Well, who was it? This Newman that said go back in history?
Yeah, it was Cardinal Newman. He said to go deep into history is to cease to be Protestant.
Right.
And, David Anders, like I say, he was a very, very staunch, like you said, a very staunch Presbyterian. The book that he's written that Lynn's talking about is a wonderful book. I've read it, too. I recommend everybody out there read it. It's got so much to say about marriage, so much that I wish my wife and I would have known. We should have known probably as Catholics, but you just don't always digest everything, especially when you're younger. And this would be great for young people. It would be great for people that are already in marriages, especially if their marriages is having trouble. It doesn't just tell about David's coming into the Catholic Church. The emphasis is on how the Catholic doctrine of marriage actually made and rejuvenated the marriage that he was already in.
Yes, his marriage, he says, was people say on the rocks or whatever. It was to the point that they didn't talk to each other other than about the children, their children. She was a fallen away Catholic and would have nothing to do with Catholic Church, and he was a Presbyterian.
And he was very anti-Catholic,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. So can you imagine a couple like this, you know, confronting the problems in marriage and so forth that they seem to have no solution for?
And he, one thing he did have, and you have to give credit to his Presbyterian parents, is they believed strongly that, you know, maybe not for the same reasons Catholics did, and I'm not sure exactly what, you know, their religious reasons were for. I think it was more of tradition than anything else, is that you just simply, you know, stay married. You don't, mm-hmm. you know, in other words, he said his mother would say, you know, murder maybe, but divorce never.
Yeah, that was his mother-in-law, wasn't it?
Or his mother-in-law, maybe, it would mm-hmm. say murder maybe. I was thinking, sometimes some people, I think, in marriage are ready to murder each other, you know, yeah. So maybe that's what she was referring to. I'm not sure, but that's the way I read it when I read it. Of course, you know, for my own life, I was sort of laughing and thinking, does she mean that it's better to murder your spouse than it is to get divorced?
No.
And of course, David and his wife weren't at that point. But the point is that in his mind, their marriage was dead. And probably in her mind, too.
In her mind, too.
And he stayed together simply because he would not give in to a divorce, because that's what he was brought up not to ever do it. And the other thing, of course, was for his children. And, of course, she for the same reasons.
And Dr. Anders, when he got his Ph.D., he was still a Presbyterian. He did not come into the Catholic Church for about 4 more years. During that time, he realized that his thinking had changed through all the reading he had done and study, that he really was a Catholic at heart. His wife recognized this, and she says, he mentioned to her about going to the Catholic Church. And she said, absolutely not. They're mean people. They are not welcoming, so on and so forth. She said, I don't want to have any part of it. They're really good in church, and then they come out of church and they'll run you over trying to get out of the parking lot, and I'm not going to go. Well, it's good. You'll have to read it to see how that part ends up. It's really a nice, good read, but I would recommend it to young people that are considering marriage even. The difference how you look at marriage makes a big difference in how you keep that marriage together.
He looked at it. He learned to look at it. And I think most Catholics need this too. We don't always, and I know, you know, we haven't in a lot of our life. You know, you get so caught up with the culture that you live in, you can't help but be influenced by it. But, you know, it looks at marriage from a sacramental point of view. And the marriage doesn't exist just for the satisfaction of two people. And it's not some kind of a goodie that the state hands out, you know, so that individuals can, you know, have something more that they can acquire, a good that they can acquire that, you know, they want to have and own. Then the institution of marriage is not just for the individuals involved. It's for all of society, that it's a means of perpetrating that society, perpetuating that society. It's a means of providing a place for children. It's a means of providing, you know, a society with a culture. It exists for more than just the people themselves. And it just not only for romantic gratification. And I think we have too much of this idea, not only in marriage, but you see it expressed by people, especially a lot of Catholics, who say, you know, I go to Mass, but I don't get anything out of it.
Yeah.
Well, it's like people coming to marriage and say, well, I'm married, but I'm not getting anything out of it. As if you approach marriage to get something out of it, as if that's the main thing. The reason people don't get a lot out of Mass, I think, is because they don't bring themselves to it with the idea that I have an obligation to worship God. And maybe they don't bring themselves to marriage with the same idea that I have an obligation to live a certain way in my community and society and start there. You know,
I was going to point out the difference that he saw between a Protestant marriage and a Catholic marriage. I had never thought about this ever before, but what he saw the differences of as the Catholic tradition opposes both contraception and sodomy in marriage. Most Protestants allow them. The Catholic Church exalts virginity, celibacy, and perfect continence over marriage. The Protestant tradition has always rejected this. He says, the Catholic Church does not allow Christian divorce and remarriage. Although Protestant values lifelong fidelity in a broad sense, Protestant tradition has always allowed divorce in at least a few circumstances, such as adultery.
Well, Luther, you know, started this idea that marriage, and Luther even suggested that the bigamy was acceptable. I think he justified it in the case of some figurehead back living in his time, under certain conditions. But this opens the floodgates because it's looking at marriage from a different point of view. It's looking at it from as if marriage was designed to give the individuals their physical and mental satisfaction, and if it doesn't do that, then somehow it's a failure. They go on to find somebody else that can. Instead of looking at it from a different point of view, the Catholic point of view that it's a sacrament and that the actual
and that you receive grace through it,
right? And the responsibility of the people to you know, respond to that grace is to help each other in their salvation. In other words, the idea of marriage is a sacrament, and sacraments, of course, are for our salvation. They're signs instituted by Christ that give grace, and they operate under their own power. In other words, we were talking about stop signs earlier. If you approach a stop sign and you see it, the sign indicates that you are to stop. But you have to do the stopping. The sign itself doesn't have any power to do that. a sacrament is different. Actually, if you are open to it, if you recognize it for what it is, it will have the power to actually give you the grace that it represents. And you have to be open to that and accept that. In other words, he never understood, David Anders, before as a Presbyterian, that you can say no to grace. Luther expounded on the idea of the bondage of the will, that those people who are predestined to be saved somehow or another are given grace against their own will. That yeah. Once they're saved, they can't, and nothing can be otherwise. The Catholic Church is not that way.
The Catholic Church regards Christian marriage as a sacrament that conveys grace. As a sacrament, Christian marriage, not all marriage, in parentheses, not all marriage.
Exactly.
Ought to be governed by the church law. Protestant tradition, rather, has always asserted that God ordains marriage, but not as a sacrament. For Protestants, marriage is a civil institution, rightly governed by civil law. Therefore, you can see from that that Protestants and Catholics have a very different view of marriage. And the one thing he did come to understand was that through marriage and the being a sacrament in your ability to be open to this grace, accepting it, and grace can be such a help for us at times. And the idea that Christ looked at the church as his bride, he even died for it, that we need to look at our partners, our marriage partners, as we are one and we have the grace from God if we use it to solidify that relationship. But it has to be done with the understanding that there are times when things aren't all peachy.
And I think the difference also between Catholicism and Protestantism that he recognized and he recognizes now is that the idea that we have to participate in our own salvation. In other words, we have to be open to grace. We have to cooperate with grace. It just doesn't happen to us. Whereas the Protestant point of view more or less is that we are sort of infinitely depraved. You know, we are totally depraved, and we are saved by Jesus Christ in spite of ourselves, not because of anything that we do. There's this works idea. Well, the church, of course, has always taught that we don't lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We don't go into heaven by works. We can't, you know, do anything to improve, you know, God, who is all everything. But we have to cooperate with the grace that we're given, and we can also say no to it. And we can refuse to cooperate with that grace. And that's the whole idea of marriage, is that the husband and wife cooperate in the grace that's given through the sacrament of marriage to help each other become, you know, justified and sanctified and on their way to salvation. To get to heaven, right. To get there, exactly.
My responsibility towards Bob and his towards me.
But we forget that so easily. We forget that. Mm-hmm. And in our whole society, it's been turned upside down with this idea that marriage is a civil institution given to us by the state, that it's a goodie that's handed out.
Right. And the idea today, too, that's very prevalent, that everyone should be happy all the time. I've always told my daughters before they got married, don't expect a perfect marriage. There's something wrong if somebody tells you they have a perfect marriage. They are not being honest. There's always something. You have to learn in marriage to accept each other. You're not going to change somebody else, but you have to accept things. You have to accept the fact that things don't always go your way, and you have to look at your partner and know when, you know, I'm pushing too far.
And I might say that
the idea of suffering.
I might say that she has always held to that idea, even though she had the perfect mate. So even though.
Oh, you're talking. Uh-huh.
Right. My wife has always held to that idea. There's no such thing as a perfect marriage, even though she had the perfect mate. And so but she never would give in to
that. I still believe it.
But seriously, again, we're going to close on this.
Yeah, and another thing about marriage. We should do a show program on marriage sometime, but the sacrament of marriage. But anyway, at this point, Dr. Andrews found through the Catholic Church the idea of suffering, carrying your cross, and uniting it to Christ, how he carried his cross, so forth. It's something that is very new to Protestants.
And his wife, too, in a sense that she had forgotten that. She, you know, had a hard, hard childhood. And then, of course, in the marriage, you know, their marriage wasn't good, and there was more suffering there. And it took a very perceptive priest to remind her that her suffering was not in vain. And that's another thing. We can offer up our suffering to God, and it's a way of accepting God's grace and cooperating with God's grace and helping, you know, cooperating in our salvation. No, the Catholic Church doesn't say that we save ourselves by works, but we're given the grace by God that enables us to do the works and cooperate with that grace, you know, to justify and get us to heaven in that sense. So we're not saying that you work your way to heaven, but we're saying that we can do the works God calls us to do if we accept his grace and cooperate with it. And that's what Lynn is saying, that suffering can help in that process.
If you have the right attitude towards suffering.
At any rate, we're going to have to stop here. It's a great book. Be sure to read it. And so we'll end our program.
Other people.
With our prayer. St. Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen. Please pray for us. We'll pray for you. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.